beginning of time, our very humanity has been based on connecting at the cellular level. Today, connecting on a cellular level has taken on a different meaning.
Welcome to the No App for Life podcast. Glad to have you hanging with us today. And if you are probably feeling like most of us right now, I think the COVID fatigue is beyond what we can handle. This whole year has been really, really challenging. As you know, I'm a media and communications professor at Manhattanville College. And in addition to the No App for Life podcast and the documentary Selling Your Soul. And so being on the front line every day with students who I ask them just at the beginning of the class, how are you feeling? And as we're all doing this remote learning, I'm looking at 25 faces in little Zoom boxes and nonverbal communication, I'm like, my students are not doing well. They look like they are really hurting. And I know the other thing is when you have younger kids, I've been talking to teachers who are really navigating some of the feedback that they're getting from parents and little kids about life in front of the screen for this past year. And I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about some of the mental health stuff that is going on. We keep hearing on the news, well, we're really worried about the mental health implications of kids and development. And what is this going to mean in the long term? What does this mean that kids have lost an entire year of socialization with one another and within school and in-class learning? And I'm very happy to have a wonderful friend and colleague and somebody who's so knowledgeable on this topic is Gene Rogers, who's the director of the Children's Screen Time Action Network, in addition to being a consultant and a parent educator. It's, of course, always so good to see you. We're doing our Zoom thing here. And most importantly, to get your input on where are we right now? What has this year meant to the developing child? And what are parents needing to think about moving forward?
It's so great to be here with you, Joni, and to be really give this topic an honest look right now. It is a really difficult time for parents. You know, pre-pandemic, we were helping families to reduce their screen time at home, even though they had ed tech happening in school. Kids were in front of screens all day at school. And so when they would come home, there'd be homework as well, helping parents to get them outside. But then the pandemic hit and everything turned out to be on a screen. And I'll tell you, the first 3 weeks, a year ago, almost, we were kind of panicked. You know, a lot of journalists and thought leaders were starting to say, oh, there's no more worry about, don't worry about screen time anymore. It's just life is all on a screen now. And then about 3 weeks in, we started getting calls from parents at the Children's Screen Time Action Network saying, this is worse than ever. This, my kids are lethargic. My kids are gaining weight. My kids are have headaches, eye strain. Anything you can imagine was happening. And they said, we need you more than ever. So now almost a year later, when we've had, you know, we've been able to see these things exacerbate, we're really working with families to set expectations for the next stage and to say, yes, you know what? We had to give ourselves a break during this time. It was tough. We may have had unemployment. We may have had be working two jobs, both parents working at home and trying to educate their children. So there's been a lot going on, a lot that we have to focus on besides screen time. But now we don't want these consequences to last. You know, we realize that kids are suffering and we don't want it to last. We have to look beyond the pandemic and start talking about what is it going to be like when we can get back. And so in the meantime, families have tried to grab nature, have tried to grab board games, have tried to grab family dinners without a screen. You know, just one little thing change that you can make in a week can really make a difference.
From a national standpoint on this, and I know how long you have been talking about these cautionary tales about screen time, digital connectivity. And, you know, the strange thing was we saw this research for so long and sort of screaming in a cavern of no one really taking it seriously. Do you feel on some level that this pandemic actually was the catalyst for finally paying attention to what you have been saying for over a decade? And maybe we would not have come to this understanding because it was sort of like, you know, the frog in the boiling water. It didn't seem as extreme, you know, it was like the slow burn. But now seeing the impact of it all converging at once, do you feel on any level now you have an opportunity to actually make a better shift?
Well, there's definitely, it's a great perspective to take, Joni. It's really something for us to think about. Did we need to be woken up by such an onslaught of screens? And it's still a little bit confusing, but I do believe the tide is beginning to turn, that people are starting to realize the consequences. In the past, we may have been just looking at one day. You know, I just have to get through this day. It's fine to hand my kids a screen. It's fine to let them do whatever they want because I'm just trying to get through this day. Now that we've all been together in these spaces, it's helped us to really see what's going on and see how disconnected we can be in the same house. And I think parents of young children are starting to understand that a lot happens in those first few years. And there really isn't, you mentioned at the beginning, a learning loss. There really isn't a learning loss in the early years because children are learning by exploring their environment. They're exploring relationships. They're exploring the world around them. And if they're not allowed to, so in a way, handing them an iPad is not allowing them to explore that world, then they do miss critical developmental stages. And so parents are starting to see that, starting to worry about it in a good way, you know, in a way that says, oh, if we pay attention now and make some tweaks, then we'll be able to, you know, not avoid some of the behavior problems that happen later in life.
And I think what I've been seeing, and again, if you're just joining us for the first time, I teach college. My expertise sort of is high school and college students. I've been talking about these cautionary tales. Like once you actually give somebody this compare and contrast of connecting organically or through a device or through a screen, we have to remember that these are the first digitally socialized population. And unless we give them these opportunities for a compare and a contrast of how it feels, I'm not sure we would have really felt that way. But I know, Jean, when you're working with parents of even younger kids, I'm concerned about, and my college kids are very, very concerned about the next generation, this concept of sort of the fish in water, right? They don't know anything else. So they're not even sure that these feelings of depression or disconnect or loneliness, they can't make that compare and contrast because this is just all they know. So what are you suggesting when you're talking to parents of younger people who are now the highest level of loneliness of the population. The most digitally connected population is the loneliest population. How might we mitigate some of those implications?
So you know what, Joni, those young people that we're talking about didn't get there overnight. We're trying to work with parents younger and younger. So trying to tell them the earlier you start implementing some systems that work particularly for your family, we can't tell you exactly what to do, but we can offer you some methods for how to do that. Let's go first of all to those young people that you're talking about in that generation. They have, it's almost worse for them as you're seeing, because they have known years of social schooling. They've been with their friends, whereas the younger kids haven't been there yet. They'll be able to adapt when they go back. They're very adaptable. But the children who've been in school and now are isolated, they're the ones having the harder time with it because they know what they're missing and they know what they need. And what we're suggesting is, yes, allow socializing on a screen, but just make sure they're getting enough sleep. Make sure it's going off at a certain time, because we know that sleep deprivation can be a direct link to that depression that we're talking about, can be a direct link to academic failure. And that's something that we're seeing in the older children, is we're seeing them lose interest in things, lose interest in their hobbies, because they're not out there playing their sports. They're not participating in school theater programs or the school band. And so having everything online is super discouraging. So we're trying to encourage at-home hobbies. Yes, socializing on a screen, but have times when it goes off. And we all need those times when it goes off. I mean, we all sleep better if we turn it off at night and if we have that screen-free day. We're coming up in May on Screen-Free Week. And to prepare, we've been encouraging screen-free Saturdays. You can, you know, anyone who's listening can look at screenfree.org and some great suggestions on just unplugging one day a week and see how it feels. It feels incredible, actually. It's not easy, but it's an incredible feeling to give yourself a break. So that's the other thing we're encouraging with those young people, is take a break.
And having that feeling that taking a break is okay, you know, and doing it together, even if you said just one or two of your best friends, like just two of us or the three of us, if you just start there. One of the things that we incorporated in both the high school program and in my college class is making phone calls, bringing phone calls back again. And it's hysterical because I give students the concept of, hey, just for a week, you're going to make some phone calls, replace some of the texts with a phone call. The panic that ensues with just the thought, I watch students literally having like a panic attack, like, no, we don't call. If I call, people will think something's wrong with me. That would be creepy. But then I'm always saying, well, listen, this is a homework assignment, so you can blame it on your horrible teacher and use the phrase, would you mind helping me out on this homework assignment? And then after they do it, they're coming back. And again, if you're over 30, you might be going, that's bizarre. But they will come to class going, oh my God, did you know you could actually hear a smile in a phone call? Oh my God, we just talked for 3 hours. And so during this time of this lockdown and trying to connect through a screen, we know that connecting in a more personal way, making that choice to listen to my friend for 15 minutes is this really loving thing. And it actually makes you feel better. So we're trying even little things like that, just giving people little strategies. I wanted to ask you, Jean, also, one of the things that you shocked me with was younger kids and developing verbal skills, because so many parents are not being in front of them face to face, or there's not enough facial interaction for 2-3-year-olds to start to build those skills. Can you tell me about that research?
Sure, Joni. So we know that the human brain, 80% of it develops in the first 3 years of life and 90% by the age of 5. So if you think of how long you live with your brain, that development in those years is super critical. And in language development, like you're talking about, the most important thing is to be looking at your child and talking to them. And some researchers have called this the new generation of neglected children, not because the parents aren't in the home with them, not because they're not feeding them or bathing them, but because they're not talking with them. And just imagine a mother is nursing her baby. She should be looking at the baby, cooing with the baby, but she's looking here at her cell phone off to the side, scrolling on her social media, perhaps, or texting. And whatever we think is more important there, there's nothing more important than talking to that baby. Reading to the baby is super important in the early years. We are trying to start a movement, Be Techwise with Baby. We have a great resource at the Action Network called Be Techwise with Baby that we did with the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association. It's free, it's available on the website, but it's for expectant and new parents to start thinking about this, because you're thinking about how to feed this baby. Am I going to use formula? Am I going to breastfeed? You're thinking about, you know, how am I going to get this baby to sleep through the night? But you're not necessarily thinking about this baby's going to emerge into a digital world. And how are we going to deal with that? And there are screens everywhere. I was talking to a parent just the other day who has a 3-year-old. And she said, we're not letting him have any screens, but we don't know how we're going to maintain this. She was kind of panicked. She knew it was important, but she came to us for support. She wants some coaching from me, some help deciding, you know, next year, what are we going to do? The following, when he goes to kindergarten, what are we going to do? You know, how are we going to make, set up a plan that supports him? And it's not about having no exposure to screens. No, we know that video chatting with grandparents is fantastic. Video chatting with a parent who might be deployed in the military, super important. So when it's a connection piece like that, and when it's developmentally appropriate, definitely a baby can be in front of a screen. But the majority of time, what they need is that communication to be able to develop their own communication skills.
It seems like, again, it's such part of our culture that we are black and white, all or nothing, you know, and it's hard to have that, raise the elevation of that conversation to say, okay, let's talk digital connectivity. I use the term making the digital distinction because there are these great utilitarian uses with our digital devices. That's a utilitarian. We're using technology right now to record this. Jean is in New Hampshire. I am in Boston. So we love technology. That's great. But it is making that distinction and changing the misconception that a digitally technological connection is in some way the same as some kind of emotional connection, right? And so that's where we keep using this word connected, 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 but it's very different. One is a wireless digital satellite connection, and another is human connection. And that's the digital distinction that we have to focus on, because the conversation can never be productive if you just start to talk about some of the downside of digital interaction. People immediately want to be defensive of the technology. And so you can't even get to the next part of the conversation to say, we're not talking about technology. We're talking about the way we're using our devices, that if we're on a device for 10 and a half hours a day, we're not then in front of our human enough, right? Is that, and that's what you're talking about with even parents and newborns. Do the math, just do the mathematical equation.
You got it. I mean, it's such a charged topic, as you're saying. There's so much guilt involved that we have to make sure parents know we're not attacking their screen time. You know, we may be making suggestions, but we're talking about the developing brain of a child. And even those teens we talked about, they're still developing. We still call them our children. I like to call them our children, you know, young people, because they're still developing as well. They still need our attention. They might be, you know, big smelly kids now, doing their sports, but they still need our attention. So that's where those device-free dinners can really come in handy. But our screens are so personal, like you're saying, you know, we have a relationship with them. And we don't think, you know, what is my relationship with my technology? And I think the teens, they just want parents to understand that. They want to understand, this is important to me. Can you listen to why it's important to me? Can you help me figure out how to reduce it? Because like you're finding, they don't want to be connected all the time to their devices. They want to be connected to their friends. They want to be connected to their family. So it's a different kind of connection. And the marketers, as you know, would have you think that that's connection. They talk about it as connection. They frame it as connection on all those beautiful ads that you see.
Well, that was how I got into this, you know, a decade ago, seeing these commercials and these ads and everything that just says, I remember, I think it was a Sony game. It was about a Sony, and where you could be playing on your game in your house, and then you could do it on your phone. And it was never stop playing. That was the ad. And I'm like, maybe you should. Like, why are you pushing never stop playing? And then taking a step back going, that was not a good message, because we know about the gaming addiction, right?
We do. And, you know, that's why parents are so confused. The message to them is so confusing. We're telling them one thing. Corporate marketers are telling them another. In fact, corporate marketers are making them think that kids need all this stuff to be successful. You know, my pet peeve is hearing parents of a 2 or 4 year old saying, well, they have to have the iPad to be college and career ready. Well, we know they have to be life ready before they can be college and career ready. And if they haven't learned how to self-regulate, if they haven't learned how to cooperate, if they haven't learned these things because they're on a screen, because it's displaced that time that they need to develop, then they're not going to be college and career ready. But that's what the marketers would have you think. So, and that's what you're talking about with digital socialization, with the fact that they've grown up with these messages and it's become like a part of them to think that that's what they need. And what they need, we know, is the human connection.
Yeah. Are there other things right now that this year has really, really alarmed you in regard to the mixed messages that are out there that you can go on record right now within this show and say, please, let's correct these misconceptions of what families, parents, and people who are using devices to this level are experiencing?
Yeah, there are a couple of things, Joni, and then there are a couple of things that give me hope. So let me start with the fact that we've seen this year more kids commit suicide due to social media bullying and die due to online challenges. It's tragic.
What do you mean by online challenges?
No, like the choking challenge, for example. Oh. Are you familiar with that? Our listeners may not be familiar with that, but an online challenge where kids will use maybe a belt, it's tragic, to choke themselves. They don't intend to kill themselves. but they get a high from preventing oxygen to their brain, and then they let go and they come back. Well, kids, you know, have had accidents, so to speak, with this kind of a challenge, and lost their lives, and parents have lost their kids. And I think when you look at the overall family, we look at the child, their children who have been involved in sports, have been involved in community, maybe a youth group, in scouting, and they're, you know, really well-rounded kids. But this part of their lives has been like secret or separate. It's been a place where parents don't know where the kids are going. It's really hard to know where your kids are going when they're not just going down the street, when they're not going to play in the neighborhood. They're going to play online. And I think this has been because of COVID. They've been inside. They haven't been going out places. And it's, you know, it's caused painful cyberbullying to happen to kids, and then, you know, participation in these really risky behaviors online. And we have a new work group at the Action Network called Cyberbullying and Online Safety to try to help parents support each other and prevent this from happening to other families. But it's a tragic result. And I think it just more awareness of what's happening on your kid's device and more communication in a way where you're not threatening them, you're not threatening to take it away from them. Because let's face it, when you're in your teens, everything is your friends. And if your friends are online at night, you want to be online at night. So it's not in a threatening way, but in a way for them to understand that you're involved and that you want to know what they're doing online, where they're going online, in order to keep them safe.
I wanted to also, one of we hear these tragic stories. And as you mentioned, I use that term digital socialization because I'm really concerned about the human socialization through a digital realm. We recently are both aware of a suicide of a young man, and it was through Snapchat, right? Through his own friends that were relentless in, well, we were just joking. So it was an exposure of a personal situation. And I mean, this kid was, you know, just got his first job, doing good in school. This is a mom being a very aware, delaying phones to her kids early on. I'm so struck by this story emotionally because I'm like, this is somebody who, a mom who did everything right. And this relentless bullying under the guise of, we were only fooling around, we're just kidding. Oh, can't you take a joke? What can you tell us about that and how kids, what can we do for younger kids who are so used to bonding through Snapchat, but something happens where there's a lack of empathy during those exchanges where you're not really understanding that what you're saying is really hurting somebody.
Yeah, so the technology is like putting up a screen. You know, it's giving those bullies license to say things that are, you know, that they would never say in person. The hopeful thing about this is that there are people working on it. So you may have seen the film, The Social Dilemma. Center for Humane Technology and others, Digital Wellness Collective, are working to design devices and to design social media so that it doesn't suck in teens the way it does. But in the meantime, these bullies are, they're anonymous in many cases. So Snapchat also has You Only Live Once, YOLO, which is anonymous. And that can be brutal. And it can be one of the things that kids hide from their families. So I think staying on top of understanding what apps are on your kid's phone is really important, and using those parental controls. Every phone comes with them. You have to look for it. It's not the first app that you see. But in your settings, those parental controls are going to be really, really critical and really help to filter out some of those apps that are pretty nasty.
Yeah. Both Jean and I have a very strong philosophy here. While all of that is changing, we know how long legislation changes. We know that, great, they're working on it. But I like how you were saying, in the meantime, here's what we can do. And in the meantime, right now, today, focusing on your human apps and focusing on connecting in a deeply emotional way, building trust between parent and child, right? Having one person that you feel, the analogy that we use in our work, our coursework, is what we call developing the lockbox relationship. So the lockbox relationship, if you have one person that you have a lockbox relationship with, and that can be a parent or a sibling or a best friend, you're making a social contract with that person that I've got your back and you've got my back. And whatever we disclose to one another about our personal feelings and our emotions, we're going to honor that and respect our privacy. And you really do have to have that kind of a relationship, because I think where things start to go really wrong is when that kid doesn't know who to turn to. Who can I go to? Because I'm really, really hurting. I'm really hurting. And that kind of connection, it can't just be through a text or through a post. You know, you have to find one person where you can have an unfolding conversation with, where you can allow the thoughts to stroll out of your mind. And again, during conversation, one thought begets another thought, right? We always say listening is love. Can I listen to you with the goal of I am going to understand you? And so that's what we've been trying to develop. You know, I think the more empowered, and you're doing the same thing, Jean, I know in both your Jean Rogers Consulting, being able to sit with families directly with these strategies. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. So when I work one-on-one with families, it's very exciting because we tailor a plan to their life, to their ages of their children. You might have a 4-year-old and a 14-year-old. How are you going to do that? You're going to definitely be allowing more for the 14-year-old than the 4-year-old. We work together on how to create a space for that and how to create the time and the situations that will support it. But with those teens that we're just talking about, it's really important. It's something that comforts adults, the parents, is to know that teens developmentally are in a place where they're meant to pull away from you. They are trying to pull away from you. So they might not want to hear this from you, the messages we're talking about today, you know, it has to go off before bed, that kind of thing. But what helps is having another supportive adult in the child's life. So it might be a coach, it might be a special teacher, it might be an aunt or uncle, a godparent, it might be a faith leader, but someone else. And I call it kind of padding the child with other adults. So you don't, it's not that you're not involved, but it's that they don't want to hear this from you necessarily, but they will hear it from someone else that they trust. And it will make the parent feel better if they know that other adult is there. And when I work with families, Joni, I don't tell them what to do. We work on a couple of different levels. One is called appreciative inquiry, and it's where I'll ask them questions and we'll explore questions and get curious about what life might be like with fewer screens. and find out what works really well for your family. I had one family tell me the bowling alley is like our second home. And that's our family. They really miss them right now, but they know that's a place where they can bond and connect without screens. So we kind of uncover those things together and they develop their own plan. I love working with families like that.
And can you tell me how when people are thinking, you know what, I think we could benefit from having a parent coach in regard to, we don't know what to do. We're getting mixed messages on all of this. Sometimes even just that initial, somebody's going to come in here and judge me. They're going to come in and they're going to tell me I'm doing everything wrong as a parent. How do you start that conversation to reassure somebody again that you're not just coming in and it's a cookie cutter, this is what you do, the end?
Absolutely not. So the way we work with families is they often want to just dump all the stress about it to begin with. I love that. I love hearing everything that they're worried about, but also everything they love about their technology, because we want to make sure we're not getting rid of those things they really appreciate about their technology. So it's not about unplugging altogether, but it's about trying some things. And then they love calling me like once a week to give me the update, the report, and saying this is working and this isn't working. It's about trying some things, but getting some suggestions from me because I have a wealth of resources. I have other experts I can connect them with. So sometimes, you know, there might be video game addiction. People are worried about that now because I have a parent who believes that the ed tech that their children have been on is creating addiction. It may or it may not be. So if you think about any kind of addiction, maybe 10% of people are going to get addicted to it. That's the same with children. We work with Dr. Hillary Cash at the Restart Life Center in the Pacific Northwest. And she tells us that not all kids will get addicted, but parents are worried that they are. So I help them to walk through that, to look for the signs, to look for what might be a problem, and to understand not all of it is a problem. That extra time now will not lead to extra time later necessarily. And my favorite parenting tool that I share with parents is set expectations. So if you want the child to only spend 30 minutes on the video game, you can't say at 30 minutes, okay, time to get off. You have to say before they get on, you're going to have 30 minutes. I'm going to come, you know, here's the timer, however you want to do it. And I'm going to come take it away in 30 minutes. And then we're going to go outside and then we're going to have dinner. And then. So the expectation is not just it's going to be over, but then we're going to do something with our human apps.
I know sometimes, however, playing the understanding of the pleasure principles and how the central nervous system works, right? Sometimes when kids get into that reward system and they're playing and they get into the, when you get to that 30 minutes and then kids end up, they're already, the chemicals in their brain are already shooting, that dopamine is kicking off on that reward system. And logically you can sit there and go, well, the 30 minutes is up, but I know we have both been in situations where we're working with parents who will say, when that 30 minutes shows up, they go into a meltdown when I want to turn it off. How can we explain what's biologically happening within the body, because parents have witnessed their kids having these real either panic attacks or meltdowns with closing down a game or taking away a phone, that real visceral experience?
Yeah, sure. So we start by telling parents to understand it's not the child's fault that they can't get off the device, that it's designed that way, that the games are designed that way, that even the social media is designed that way, that setting that expectation ahead of time is not always going to work. These things are not always going to work, but also developing a pattern with it. Often you have to put up with those meltdowns for a week. It's often the time I see is like, after 7 days, we got it here. 30 minutes might not be practical. It might be an hour, or it might be 30 minutes and then an extra 15 minutes. But habits don't form in one day, in a couple of days. And so there's some teeth gritting that happens when we start implementing a methodology with a family, and that's why they can call me. They can talk about it with me and say, this is working, this isn't working. But it's also important to have that conversation with the child to say, this is what's happening to you. It's not your fault either. And we know you're having a lot of emotions around this. And even with the meltdown, are you angry? We know you're angry that we're taking this away now, that it's time to stop, that we've put the timer on and the timer's going off. But we also know that there are other things in life that you're going to love and appreciate as we keep going here. So for everybody to understand, the industry has been against you.
When you're talking, Gene, I'm going, okay, Gene Rogers is like the modern day Ferber method. Remember when you would try to get your kid to sleep and you're like, they're screaming and crying and I'm standing outside the door going, I'm the worst parent ever. And then having to go, but if I get through this week, we'll all be sleeping better. Do you remember, like, with your kids doing the Ferber method? Did I get that right?
Yeah, I don't remember that, but I remember the nanny. Do you remember the nanny?
Yeah.
I'm like the digital nanny. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. And you're like, I have to do this because it's the right thing to do. Because being a parent and having to watch your kid having a meltdown is so scary. You know, it's really scary. And so parents are very afraid to watch that level of emotion.
They are, and with the pandemic, we know that some parents worried about addiction and then it didn't happen. But we also know some parents were then at home with a child who was actually addicted. And then those behaviors are very scary. And that's where I can pull on my experts. That's where I can call Dr. Cash. I can call Dr. Kennedy out in the digital treatment center in Colorado. And, you know, we have people who can help when there is a serious situation.
We have a few minutes left because I'm grateful for the time that you're giving here today. I know you have a very, very busy schedule. Tell me about the Children's Screen Time Action Network. What is the mission of the network? You are the director of this. This was your baby. You have these most incredibly brilliant people from so many walks of technology, the digital world, that you've pulled together. Tell me a little bit about your vision for this when you started it and where you are now.
Thanks, Joni, for asking. The Children's Screen Time Action Network is a collaborative of practitioners, many pediatricians, psychologists, school psychologists, educators, administrators, advocates, and parents who are all working to reduce the excessive use, harmful use of screens in childhood. And we were launched in November of 2017. We had about 500 members then. We held a conference in Boston where I met Joni Ciani and was introduced to NOAP for Life. And we have screen time issues are not one thing. They're not obesity. They're not eyesight. They're not depression. They're many things. And so we pulled together experts in all these areas. And we also are a home for people doing screen time work who feel isolated, who feel like this is an uphill battle. It's not when we work together. And we've been able to do some fantastic projects. Our Screens in Schools work group put together an action kit for parents so that parents who want to go to their school administrations and are worried have templates, have the words to be able to say, have the confidence because the research is there. And our other work groups. We have our interfaith work group just starting because people are concerned about children's character development with regards to screens, mental health professionals, parent educators, early childhood. So we're looking at all these different areas and we're saying if we work together, we can really make progress to support children and families in the digital age. We're growing. We're now 1,500 members globally. It's very exciting. And there are micro partnerships happening. People who meet at our Let's Talk coffees once a month, and anybody's welcome to come. Find us at screentimenetwork.org and you'll see our resource library. You'll see our Action Network Live series where I interview the experts, where I'm on the other side of the microphone. And we continue to address issues of persuasive design, like we're talking about here, apps that manipulate young children into buying things, and these issues of cyberbullying and educational technology where kids may be accessing pornography. We look at all these serious issues every day, and we come together to create simple actions that we can take toward a solution.
And that's why Gina and I have been so symbiotic, because I loved the fact that it was the Action Network, because I got so tired after a decade of going to conferences and the world of academia and everybody pontificating about the problem. And it's a problem. And I was like, right, that's why we need solutions. I need to know. And both in my film, Selling Your Soul, and in the book, Selling Your Soul, and I learned from my students. Well, I'll never forget this kid in the back of the room who said, I got it, Joni. Just tell me what to do. Just tell me what to do. And I was like, now I get it. They're looking for solutions. Tell me what to do when my kid is having a panic attack, when the phone gets taken away, or they drop their phone, or they lose their phone. I need those strategies. Tell me what to do to get my kid to limit the gaming for 30 minutes. How do I do that? So again, between Gene Rogers, myself, Screen Time Action Network, we can connect you to whatever issue or problem you're going through, no matter what it is. You can just start by either emailing us, getting in touch with us. We'll find you the right person. I know that that's what they do. That's what you're doing at Screen Time Action Network and also GeneRogersConsulting.com. So either way, we're on your side. If you finally feel like I need to do something, we can get you to the right people. So, and get through this crazy year. I'm done with it.
It's definitely a crazy year, Joni, but we're hopeful. You know, we're hopeful.
That's good.
Because we work together.
Yeah.
Improving life for children and families, just helping everyone to see the joy in it.
Yeah, and we need this level of human support, you know, no judgment. This is a no judgment zone. This is, I hear you. We're all in the same situation. I know sometimes on social media, the sort of comparison culture, you know, people in there like, life is great. And it's somebody going, I'm not feeling that, right?
No, you know, and we know all families have their strengths. All individuals, we have our strengths, and that's where we start. We start with, what are your strengths? And let's start from there to create the solutions.
Great. Well, you gave us enough to start to work on, even just those little tips that we got through this podcast today. But the conversation will continue. Again, you can reach out to Gene at GeneRogersConsulting.com or Children's Screen Time Action Network. Of course, you can always email me here at noappforlife@gmail.com. We'll put that all up under our podcasting information. And again,
Thank you to Gene Rogers. Thank you for listening. Please tell your friends. If you have a topic that you'd like us to cover, please make sure I know about it and we'll get you on. Thank you again for being part of the No App for Life podcast, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you, Joni.